My name is Michael Guyett, publisher of The Lead Lag Report. Joining me for the rough hour is Mr. Stephen Sykes. Stephen, introduce yourself to the audience and to me a little bit more formally. Who are you? What's your background? How'd you get involved in public? And what are some of the things that you're doing right now?
Yeah. Hey, thanks for having me. Really excited to be here and to talk to the audience and talk about sort of retail investing and what we're seeing. First, my background. So I'm the COO at Public. As part of my responsibilities, I also sort of lead our broker dealer and I lead all of our regulated functions, which means as we're talking about sort of the platform from a capital market perspective and what are we doing sort of helping retail investors access the various asset classes we do, like I'm at the tip of the spear and I spend all of my time thinking about how to build a great sort of multi-asset investment platform for, you know, the modern generation of retail investors. And I think before I was at Public, where I've been here about 3.5 years, coming up on 4 years, Public itself is, you know, a relatively young, certainly mighty firm. I was at SoFi, where I helped start sort of all the SoFi Invest businesses and ran those as the business lead for a few years. So anyway, that's my quick CV. I think the 2 seconds on Public, just hopefully most of the listeners are familiar, or hopefully more than a few have our Public members and, you know, have chosen us to be their primary investment account. But I think that's what we're aiming for. That's where we see our place in the industry, right? Is we want to be, you know, sort of the modern multi-asset brokerage for retail investors. And I think that means not just offering sort of the standard equities, crypto options, but we do want to bring a broader set of asset classes to bear so that retail investors can build a great sort of self-directed portfolio. And, you know, we certainly see ourselves in a position where we started our journey serving long-term investors, focusing on building a business there. And over time, we've sort of broadened out to include things like options trading. And I think we've started to see a significant growth in sort of what I would call like the trader end of the spectrum among our member base and seeing some interesting insights there. But anyway, that's me, that's Public. I do pride myself on putting myself on the community among retail investors. So I'm an easy guy to reach. So if anything's interesting that you hear on the conversation, or if you ever have any questions about Public, feel free to DM me on Twitter or find me on Reddit, where I'm increasingly spending more time. So anyway, back over to you, Michael.
I feel like we should define properly what a retail investor is. I say that because I think the impression for a number of years, I think it was largely true, was that retail was just code for saying relatively little money that's trading. It's not the big money that's moving things around. At Public, how do you think through that archetype of what a retail trader investor is?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is for people that don't do it professionally, I think is the answer, right? And certainly there are people on sort of, it might be categorized more broadly as professional asset, or, you know, or view sort of day trading as their profession or trading as their sort of profession, right? Whether they're retired or just, you know, managing their own assets. But generally, we think about people that aren't sort of on the institutional end of the spectrum. So it's quite a broad spectrum. I think what we've seen over the last, you know, several years of development in the industry is like retail can mean everything from, you know, the 18-year-old who's opening up their first brokerage account, investing $10, $50, $100 a week and starting to really build their long-term portfolio, all the way through to people who are professional software developers that write their own algorithms to trade the options market, right? I think like both of those things sort of fit in the modern spectrum, right? And sort of the definition, which is interesting. We've seen that evolve. I think certainly probably the presence of both ends of that spectrum have grown over the last few years relative to maybe what you would have thought of 15 or 20 years ago in the industry.
As I think the other impression is that, and I say this with a broad brush, that, you know, retail can be equated to, in quote, dumb money, which I never liked that term because it has nothing to do with intelligence. But going back to your point about professional versus, you know, non-professional, presumably has to know the industry and know what they're doing and talking about. Retail, if they're not doing it as a career, you know, is maybe doing it based on other dynamics, maybe less informed than the professional players. Let's talk about the education level on average. If from what you've observed, retail is perhaps smarter to market dynamics or more understanding of the way that investments work.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one, I'll say incredibly hard to generalize about the retail market for the same reason I just, you know, said earlier. There's a huge diversity of profile segments of goals and aims and strategies among sort of the retail investor base. But I think there are a couple of things that, you know, we've witnessed and I've witnessed over the last few years in the industry, which are increasing what I would say the sort of quality of investment decision and an improvement in outcomes for retail investors. So I think first and foremost, I think we are in an age of dramatically increasing adoption of just like investing among sort of the consumer population, right? I think we've never seen a higher penetration of individual investment accounts among consumers in the U.S. And that continues to grow healthily, you know, even though we had massive explosion in sort of 2020, 2021 with sort of the COVID era. I think we've continued to see really strong growth there and massive penetration. And the interesting thing is, like, you're seeing that actually grow among younger cohorts to an even greater degree. I think if we like zoomed back to 2018, you know, we would see that like sort of the millennial generation for prior, you know, sort of call it 2009 to 2018 was massively underpenetrated in terms of investable assets and investment accounts. I think that script totally flipped from really started in 2019, to be honest, but really 2019, 2020, 2021, we saw a massive growth in retail investment accounts among the millennial generation. And now it far outpaces sort of prior generations in terms of adoption of sort of individual equities and investing. And that tends to skew more self-directed, which comes to my second point, which is I think that sort of increase in self-directed investing is largely driven by the massive improvement in both like trading accessibility. So better platforms, you know, lower costs, better products, and the massive explosion in information available to retail investors, largely for free. I mean, I think if we zoomed out 15 years ago, you know, just getting like real time streamed quotes would have been something most brokers would charge for, or you'd have to have a very high individual account minimum to get your sort of free quote stream, right? Most everything was a sort of 15-minute delay. I remember my first brokerage account that I opened in the early 2000s. Like, I literally had to pay if I wanted to get real-time quotes. Now that's like tick by tick, level two data, et cetera, all available for retail investors for free at the, you know, on a variety of platforms with a $0 minimum investment amount. And I think that proliferation of like, you know, better tools, better products, and better information, I've made retail investors be more confident and ultimately have significantly better outcomes. And yeah, I think there are a few proof points of that. Again, from the data I alluded to earlier about adoption of products, but like the one that like I sort of intuitively like to point out is like, you know, there's a big narrative on sort of retail trading volumes and behaviors over the last several years in aggregate, right? I think in 2020 and 2021, you know, sort of the retail percentage of the equities trading market grew dramatically. And then really in 2022 and 2023, that fell. And that's true in the equities market. But in the options market, it didn't fall, right? And the retail sort of percentage of sort of options trading volume throughout 2022, 2023, and even into 2024 has stayed pretty consistent, which is interesting, right? I think as we think about retail investors, you know, we think about options being the riskier product. I think in a downturn and a tougher equities market, you would expect options penetration to actually decrease more than the equities perspective. I think that's what we had seen in sort of prior market cycles. But for this particular market cycle, that hasn't been the case. And I think part of that is actually like retail investors are having, you know, when what we would broadly count as retail investors are actually having better outcomes, trading more sophisticated instruments like options than prior generations of sort of traders, retail traders had.
Yeah, the part of course of this is the tremendous proliferation of interest in crypto. Really post 2020. And I know you're on the public side doing or give access to some crypto products. Let's talk about that, because if you mentioned that there's obviously been a younger cohort. And from my impression, a younger cohort likes crypto more than equities.
You know, I don't know that I would say a younger cohort likes one more than the other. I think, you know, crypto is broadly among younger cohorts going to be, you know, broadly more, have a higher consideration, let's say, as younger retail investors approach their portfolios, like certainly more likely to consider crypto as having a portion of their portfolio. I think we see those sort of trends, but I don't know that I would say it's like a binary preference of crypto markets over, you know, equities markets. I think they're both pretty well adopted in younger cohorts. You know, in the last, you know, this quarter or really since the start of the year, the crypto markets have certainly been interesting with the introduction of sort of the first Bitcoin ETFs, spot Bitcoin ETFs, and seeing the growth there and seeing retail investor behaviors. When you do have, you know, sort of the equity style access to a crypto asset for the first time.
All right, let's get into the weeds as far as some of the things that you're seeing in terms of just broader activity from retail investors using Public as a platform. You sent me a note saying that you're seeing in general an increase in speculative behavior, which I'm not surprised by, because that's what happens, especially towards, you know, top, I think more often than not. Let's go through some of the more interesting observations that you've made as far as the activity on Public by those that are, you know, maybe smaller account size, very retail, and are very much sort of trading rather than investing.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it's one of, even on the Public platform, right? We have millions of customers. It's hard to draw, you know, with a super broad brush. So you know, caveat emptor here. Like it's, you know, it is what it is. I'll give you my own impression. One, I think, you know, Michael, you said something interesting, which is, hey, seeing this trend towards speculative behavior might signal a top and so on. I don't really have an opinion of that, but to say Q1 was very different than sort of some of the, you know, prior rallies that we'd seen, call it, you know, in August of 2023, right? We'd had some decent, you know, again, some decent rallies in the equities market. And we didn't see those sort of pull through in the same way. And we didn't see sort of see the same increase in sort of retail speculation, and especially on sort of the most speculative end of the spectrum that we have in Q1 here. So I don't want to say like, you know, I don't want to nullify the point. I just want to say this was a little different than what we've seen in quite a long time from retail investors. And I think there are a few, you know, some sort of thematic macro explanations. Some are sort of idiosyncratic. Maybe we'll start with the idiosyncratic because I think those are like a bit more interesting. First, I think we saw, again, the introduction of the Bitcoin ETFs, right? I think that drove a lot of just broad publicity and, you know, and awareness and familiarity of these products, with which led to a lot of retail interest. And it didn't immediately upon launch lead to big Bitcoin price appreciation, but we have seen it lead to Bitcoin price appreciation, you know, sort of over the last several months. And I think we've seen that sort of reinvigorate, you know, the sort of crypto markets and some of the speculation there. And I think, you know, that has both been, again, our members can access crypto through a partnership we have with Bakkt, which is, you know, big publicly traded crypto as a service platform. Our customers, you know, we've seen sort of what their behaviors, you know, with sort of the Bakkt product. I think we see their, you know, it's sort of barbelled right now, right? It's like either Bitcoin or at the more speculative end of the spectrum with like the Dogecoins and the Shiba Inu coins and so on. And so I think it's been interesting to see how, as we've seen sort of, you know, the rising tide of Bitcoin float all boats in crypto, you know, we have seen some allocation, an increasing allocation towards some of the more speculative tokens there. So that's one, I think, idiosyncratic, like, but I think that, you know, was sort of the starting gun of some of the more speculative behavior we've seen. And then I think, you know, that followed with a couple of like, you know, with one interesting IPO. The Reddit IPO was obviously well followed among retail investors, and particularly sort of the more trader end of the spectrum. And I think, you know, we saw a lot of interest in the Reddit IPO. And then, you know, on the heels of the Reddit IPO, we had the DWAC to DJT SPAC conversion and the price appreciation there, which led to a lot of volatility. And then the last thing we've seen more recently in the last couple of weeks is the introduction of this Destiny 100 tech fund, DXYZ. And that again has had massive volatility, price appreciation, selling off, you know, and I think like probably a truism. And I think I said this in a different forum a couple of weeks ago, like, you know, a couple of things that we can predictably, you know, that predictably drive retail interest and behavior. You know, one is familiarity. So things they know and understand and see in the markets. So like, again, Bitcoin ETFs, Reddit, everyone knows that, like that's going to drive a lot of interest. DJT, certainly super well covered. And I think that's going to drive interest. But the second is volatility, right? And I think we see volatility, and that's going to draw sort of, again, among the sort of trader profiles in the retail world, that's going to draw a lot of interest. I think, you know, we have seen sort of an interesting intersection of highly volatile instruments combined with things that retail investors tend to be familiar with, really leading to sort of, you know, increase in this sort of speculative behavior in Q1. And again, I think that's sort of the idiosyncratic explanation. And, you know, sitting in a platform like I do, I tend to like, you know, see these things in real time and see the numbers move and see the charts go up into the right. And like, that leads me to like sort of understand the micro of it. But the macro of it is what you said, Michael, which is like, you know, regardless of where you're looking across the equities market, we've seen a pretty strong rally to start the year. And, you know, certainly we saw a lot of, you know, price appreciation in some of the large equity names, you know, mostly NVIDIA. But at the same time, you've got Apple and Tesla massively lagging sort of the year-to-date rally. So it's not really this like magnificent, you know, this pan magnificent seven rally. I think at the same time as you've seen sort of that, you've also seen sort of the, you know, I don't know, the Russell IWM, sort of the long tail of public equities also catch up, right? And I think it's been this sort of, I don't want to say it's a total barbell outcome, but you've definitely seen sort of the small cap world outpace some of the large cap world in a way that we hadn't seen in prior rallies. And I think that also sort of, you know, that sort of encourages retail investment, especially on the more speculative end of the spectrum.
Do you get a sense that retail in general prefers individual story stocks and doesn't really trade ETFs as much? I have to assume that's a part of sort of where the attention gets focused.
Again,
we'll be back after a quick break. Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
Hard to generalize because there certainly we have retail investors that love to trade individual sector ETFs or lever ETFs, right? Like that, there are retail investors that pursue those strategies. I think generalizing, right? If we were going to generalize, I think retail investors, long-term investors are going to focus on sort of broadly diversified index funds. And then they're going to build a constellation of, you know, individual equities that they know and believe in, right? And they're going to hold those for the long term. On the trader side, certainly, I think we're going to see trading more focused on individual equities than ETFs and sort of, and again, individual equities and their, you know, the options on said individual equities are going to be where retail investors express sort of their points of view, more so than sort of ETFs as a trading vehicle among the retail market.
Since you mentioned volatility is a big part of this, when markets get more volatile, do you tend to see more shorting across the platform, more turnover? What's the response? I know I'm talking generalizations like all these other questions, but what do you typically find as sort of the response when there's high volatility?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So, you know, we launched our options platform in mid-January. And that was really the first opportunity for public members to be able to take a short position, right? We didn't allow sort of direct shorting of stocks for a variety of reasons, but, you know, sort of long put buying was the first opportunity we gave our members to really sort of express those short positions, which was very interesting to watch and observe. Quick plug for, like, you know, trading options on public. You know, we built what we think is the best deal for options traders. Basically, it's no fees, no commissions. And, you know, we rebate part of the payment for order flow we receive from sort of the exchanges or market makers. We rebate part of that on every single trade to our investors. So it literally, when you do the math on every trade, there's cash, you know, there's sort of a cash in the pocket outcome of trading options versus paying, you know, 65 cent sort of contract charges at some of the larger brokers, et cetera. So yeah, we've intentionally built a platform we think is great for options traders and does present the best deal in the market. So quick plug there. I think what I've been really interested in over time is seeing how that mix of sort of put call buying exists, right? And I think when we do see more volatility, we are certainly seeing increases in sort of put buying relative to call buying, and you can sort of follow it on a day by day basis, right? And I think, you know, especially when you look at it, and I think the probably the right way to look at it is actually as a nominal matter rather than a contract matter. And like, for sure, on days where we see down days, big red days, we do see retail investors following that negative momentum and increasing their put buying relative to their call buying. And again, that continues to be true across individual names. But I do think it's more of a, I do think we see a trend towards following the momentum, whichever direction that goes in, versus sort of fading the rally or fading the sell-off.
The other impression I have of retail investors is they tend to take concentrated bets, meaning it's not the sort of institutional mindset of asset allocation, diversification, right? There's no necessarily a hard limit as far as, you know, how much you would put in an individual stock. Am I off on that idea that there isn't sort of as much thought to how much concentrated risk to take in a position as a retail trader investor?
Yeah, I think certainly it is not, you know, it's not at the extent of, you know, risk management that you would see from an institutional investor. That's for sure true. But I think the thing to remember, I think, and this is true of the vast majority of our members and so on, is that retail, sort of, I've been drawing this dichotomy between retail investors and retail traders. And I think that's a little bit of like a simplification. I think the reality is, most people using public, most retail investors, to some degree, are both, right? They both have positions that they view as sort of shorter term trades, and then they have sort of longer term investments. Certainly, there are people that do only one or the other, but the vast majority of people live somewhere in the middle. And I think they all sit with sort of, you know, those people that sit in the middle sit on a foundation of, like, you know, having a very well diversified core portfolio of index funds that, you know, sit in their individual brokerage account. It might sit in their 401k, right? So I think there are a lot of people who are sort of speculating in the equities market, you know, or with a portion of their assets, and they're willing to take more concentrated positions with those sort of marginal dollars, right? But because they've got the comfort of sort of the broad sort of market exposure that they have through other vehicles. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think that's well articulated. Now, of course, the other part of this is how retail thinks, if at all, about interest rates. The narrative was that the market can't rally with rising rates. A market did, large caps, small caps, obviously not so much. Talk about, from your perspective, what you're seeing in terms of investor understanding of what's happened in this cycle, right? How retail traders, investors tend to respond to monetary policy shifts, what the mentality tends to be, and how that can change.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's a complicated thing. And I think as you think about real people investing real, you know, we'll focus on like after tax dollars, just as a simplifying thing. I think as you look at retail investors, I think, you know, most people are having this considered, you know, internal dialogue of like, how much should I be saving versus how much should I be investing, right? And I think most people we found, especially if you talk to our members, sort of separate those two things. And, you know, people tend to think about savings in terms of obviously like lower risk, sort of FDIC type accounts, you know, and what they're focused on is earning, you know, sort of a yield. But like for most people, that is the default is actually to save. And then the sort of decision becomes to invest. And I think what we've seen in some places is a bias towards, you know, when interest rates rise and that risk-free rate rises, that has a dramatic impact on retail investors because the sort of opportunity cost of their investment dollars goes up, right? And I think, you know, in a very like, you know, it's intuitive, but it's also like a very financially sound theory sort of take on the world. But like when retail investors see that they can get, you know, on public, it's like a 5.1% high yield cash account, or we have a treasury account. It's, you know, I can't remember with six month T-bills are, I don't know, 5.36 right now. When they see those opportunities, they're like, wait, I can get like 5.1% in a, you know, FDIC insured account, or I can get 5.3%, you know, lending money to the federal government, like, you know, in a tax advantaged way. Like they feel pretty good about that. And that does, it certainly like increases their proclivity to like take, you know, actually take less risk first. Right. And view that as sort of part of their broader foundation. And I think what we've seen is like, if we zoomed out on the whole cycle, like that was really dramatic in, you know, throughout late 2022 and early 2023. And we launched sort of the aforementioned treasury account into that market. And it was by far the biggest sort of flow generating product for public in 2023. And like to a really dramatic degree. Now what we've seen is like, as sort of, you know, the risk-free rate has stagnated around, you know, between 5 and 5.5%. And sort of the 6 month T-bill rate has like, you know, mostly steadied in the 5.3s, you know, we've seen that become a little more ho-hum. And I think whereas in 2023, we saw retail investors be very excited about a 5% yield that they hadn't seen in, you know, basically a generation. And for many of our investors, never in their adult lives, you know, myself included, right? Like, I think we saw them very excited about sort of taking advantage of those risk-free yields. But as that's because as the rates haven't gone up anymore, I think that's become less attractive and it's become, you know, less of a driving force in terms of where people are allocating. That being said, I think where we at Public, you know, the other thing that we've launched recently is our, you know, bond trading platform. So our members can directly trade underlying bonds on Public now, you know, and I think that's a selection of 10,000 bonds across the full sort of treasuries and corporate universe. And I think we've started to see retail investors now look at places where, okay, a 5% is ho-hum and maybe, you know, TBD, a few weeks ago, I would have said, you know, we're going to get some cuts and that rate's going to go down throughout the course of this year, maybe not anymore. But I think what we're anticipating and what we've started to see the early innings of is retail investors actually starting to reach for yield. And so I think as they start to plan for rate going down, they're like, oh, can I like buy a 2-year treasury bond, right? Because I'm going to lock that in around 5%, right? I think like people are starting to see, you know, they got comfortable earning their 5% risk-free and like they want to try and lock that in. And I think they're starting to express that within the treasuries market. And I fully expect as rates actually do fall, I think reaching for some of that yield in the corporate market is going to be a really interesting dynamic and something that we're going to pay close attention to because again, you know, earning, you know, 5%, 6%, 7% yields on a fixed income instrument when most retail investors have been trained to sort of think about earning, you know, 5 to 10% long-term compounding rates in the equities world, like to get that in a fixed income instrument is novel. And I think, you know, it does change the decision-making for retail investors.
Just to reset the room for the remaining 20 minutes, folks, please make sure you follow Stephen Sykes here on X. If any of you want to come up and ask questions, click that bottom left mic request button. And as always, this will be in podcast under Lead Lag Live on all of your favorite platforms. I am curious, just given the access to those 10,000 bonds, because again, I don't necessarily think of retail as wanting to play with the corporate credit bond market side, because there's a lot more action in stocks as opposed to bonds, as you know. Have there been some good adoption there? Have you seen more and more retail investors on Public's platform going and selecting individual bond securities to put money to work in?
Yeah, totally. We're seeing strong adoption, and we're happy with the progress of the product so far. I think there are a couple like caveats. One, I think you're exactly right, right? This is not an asset class that retail investors have directly accessed before, right? Typically, I think as we look at the numbers, the percent of retail investors that directly hold the bond is something like single digit percentage points, right? I think as you look at exposure to the asset class, though, I think we see a much higher percentage, but most people invest in sort of bonds through a bond fund. And I think what we've started to see, and this started with the treasury account we launched and sort of underpinned this hypothesis, is actually like retail investors, like bonds are just like weird, and like as weird as like bonds are, actually bond funds are weirder and they're harder to understand and people don't understand what yield to expect and so on. So retail, and again, this is a little bit of a truism, has especially self-directed retail, has been historically under allocated toward the bond market relative to the equities market. And so I think part of our mission where we've started is to actually make accessing those 10,000 bonds, and again, a nice liquid part of the bond world, as easy to access, understand, and trade as sort of the equities market. And I think we are in the early innings of doing that. We're starting to see a bunch of retail interest in doing so. I think the next big thing for us, I think one of the barriers to the retail market is like, you know, the bonds trade in, you know, sort of denominations of par, which is usually $1,000 face value, right? And so I mean, you know, most bonds are going to trade at a minimum ticket size of $1,000. And like, hey, you know, we have a large portion of our membership that can easily allocate towards, you know, $1,000 towards an individual position. But to do that and try and build a diversified portfolio and do it across an asset class that's less familiar and a trading experience that's less familiar, certainly like a higher barrier to entry. So one of the things we've announced and should be rolling out in the next couple of weeks will be sort of fractional access to a portion of that 10,000 bond portfolio. So, you know, call it, you know, $50, $100 minimum ticket size rather than sort of $1,000 or $5,000 as can sometimes be the case across the bond market. So we're excited to see, hey, how does giving sort of slightly better or much better accessibility, much lower price point, allow retail investors to, you know, learn by doing within the asset class and build sort of more diverse portfolios of bonds and, you know, that are more sort of tailored to their duration and risk needs relative to otherwise. By the way, the story I do like to tell here, and like this is, unfortunately, we didn't have the products live for this experience, but like this is the sort of thing I'm looking forward to in the future. I don't know if you followed or how many of your listeners followed sort of the AMC Theaters journey over the last couple of years. But the short version is AMC Theaters, massive meme stock, needed to raise money because of financial challenges coming out of COVID, but they were unable to increase their share authorization count in the state of Delaware because they couldn't get, you know, sufficient of their retail shareholders to vote in the proxy. Even though it won as a percentage of people that voted, they couldn't get to the majority of shareholders voting their shares. And so they were left in this weird position where, you know, they needed to sell stock, but they couldn't do it. They ultimately figured out a workaround with this sort of second preferred share class called APEs. And what happened when AMC started issuing, you know, APEs and ultimately issued equity to shore up its balance sheet, all of the retail shareholders that owned the equity, you know, lost a lot. The equity, I think, fell somewhere on the order of like 90%+ in value as sort of this, you know, fundraising took place in the capital markets for AMC. So that's what happened on the equity side. The equities lost, you know, 80, 90, 95% of value, depending on exactly when the retail investors entered. But what happened on the fixed income side? What happened on the bond side of the balance sheet? What happened on the credit side of the balance sheet? As AMC, you know, raised all of this money, the risk to the bonds went down dramatically because AMC was suddenly in a much better financial position as a company and those bonds rallied. And so if retail investors, again, a priori, if they had said, hey, I want to support AMC, I can do that both by buying the equity or I can support them by buying the bond. If they had built, say, a 60-40 portfolio of those two things over the same time period, they would be far better off than they were just, you know, exclusively exposed to the equity. And again, I want to see those sorts of opportunities play out for retail investors in a way that hasn't been possible before. And so again, that's just an example of one situation where, hey, it makes sense intuitively in the, you know, sort of the microcosm of a single company to play both sides of the balance sheet, to own a diversified exposure to sort of the company's outcome, whether it be as a creditor or an equity holder. And I think, you know, there's a strong reason for retail investors to do that. And Mike, if you ask, you know, the management team at AMC, they would have been just as happy to have retail investors supporting the bond in the bond market as supporting the equity in the equities market, right? They would have been completely neutral to those two things. And I think the company, you know, would have been better off for having, you know, sort of a retail bondholder base in addition to a retail shareholder base.
Yeah, that's excellent.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
Very interesting way of framing it, an example on AMC. I am the concern that I would have with a screener and you know, the ease with which somebody can buy a bond is I can easily imagine a whole bunch of people basically just screen for the top yielding individual bond and then buy that with no regard for default risk, credit risk, all this stuff. I don't know if you have any visibility of the clicks that happen on that page, but how do people even go about trying to figure out among these 10,000 bonds which one to pick?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's a lot easier to do with individual stocks because there's headlines, there's clear momentum, there's winners there. You don't have the same kind of movement that causes a bond to rise to the top like you do with stocks.
Yeah. So interestingly, I had the same concerns, right? I think thinking about this as a self-directed platform, we've talked about this a fair amount, right? Retail investors are going, often allocate toward the more speculative end of the equities spectrum, for instance. And the truth is, like, we're dealing in an asset class that is definitionally lower risk than sort of some of those same speculative bets made in the equities world. So even the more, you know, even the riskier end of the fixed income spectrum is probably a much less risky instrument, again, and every circumstance is a little different. It's probably much less risky than sort of the marginal speculative investment that happens, you know, on the tails of the equities world. So starting from a place of like, we're talking about a much lower risk asset generally just because of where it sits in the cap table of these companies. But at the same time, I had the same question, which is like, hey, are we going to see retail investors broadly skewing to like just sort by yield and just like buying the highest risk, you know, high yield bond they can? And the truth is they're not. Actually, where we see most of the dollars going into from a bond perspective, you know, unsurprisingly, treasuries market. And then maybe a little more surprisingly, it's going to be in sort of large retail equities names. So we're seeing a lot of allocation towards, you know, the investment grade, Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Nvidia. Those are the names where we're actually seeing increasing bond buying. Again, because I think, you know, retail investors are viewing that sort of investment grade opportunity as, okay, I know what I can get in sort of 6 month T-bills. Okay, I can find a sort of short duration instrument in one of the Mag 7, et cetera, investment grade bond, and I can capture the 20, 30, 40 basis points of spread there and get a little bit better with, you know, managed credit risk. And I think that sort of buying behavior is mostly what we're seeing. We're seeing sort of a rational focus on capturing the spread to treasuries that investment grade can present. So certainly we do see some of the speculative high yield bond buying, but that's not the majority by any stretch.
So our industry, as you know, is very cyclical, right? And it's all a function of sort of whether you're in an expansion or a recession. I would make the assumption that sitting in your seat or sitting in you know, an executive type of level at a brokerage or asset management firm, you'll see things earlier than the headlines would report. And what I mean by that is you'd see more and more additions to accounts or more and more redemptions, right? In terms of money going in to be traded or money going out to be used for paying expenses. What are some of the broader trends in terms of, in aggregate, money flow? Meaning, are you seeing that a lot of the investors on public are actively adding to their accounts, that they're so flush from income sources that they're able to just kind of increase their portfolio? Or are you seeing maybe at the margin, you know, some people pulling money out, maybe because they just can't afford things as easily as they used to?
Yeah. And so this one's a hard one to answer because it's really difficult to separate, you know, sort of the nuances of Public as a platform and all of the work we do to create a great investment experience, like, which again, we find always in help, you know, increases the amount of flows that we see into the market, right? We make changes, we improve the platform, we offer new products, that's going to increase sort of the inflow. So it's very hard to like separate that from like what is truly the macro driver. But I'll tell you, I think as we look at, as I think about it intuitively on like, you know, a quote unquote same store sales basis, right? If we were just looking at the same cohort and the same set of products, et cetera, I think Q1 was, you know, saw massive inflows, right? I think we saw a lot of retail investors both, you know, increasing their savings rate into products like our high yield cash account and the treasury account. I think we've seen, again, massive inflows into, you know, large retail equities, index funds, and so on. And I think we started to see some inflows into sort of the speculative end of the spectrum as we talked about earlier. But I think broadly speaking, sort of Q1 was a phenomenal flows quarter. I think we did see, you know, some of the usual tax day headwinds that you can expect among sort of self-directed retail brokers as some subset of the population had capital gains in their brokerage account from 2023 and, you know, owed a tax bill to Uncle Sam. And so that does on the margin sometimes drive outflows for a few weeks. But generally speaking, as we look at sort of the total inflows and total net flows for the platform, again, some of this being specific to Public, I think we see a really healthy consumer, right? And I think that echoes what we've seen in the macro data around the job market and income. You know, I think a couple other things I think that are interesting. One, you know, we are monitoring sort of this long-term trend of the health of consumer balance sheets. I think there's, in macro circles, there are a lot of conversations about the surplus savings that, you know, sort of the average American developed over the course of 2020 and 2021, and how that sort of started to burn down over the last several years. And we are still at a place of sort of saving surplus within the sort of consumer economy. But I think all of the sort of pretty charts I've seen from the large macro firms, I think we're seeing that start to taper out. And so we're going to be interested to see if, you know, how much that sort of balance sheet, that surplus savings disappearing and getting back to sort of 2019 trend. We're starting to see like, okay, how does that impact flows on an ongoing basis? Again, haven't seen any evidence there, but we're paying close attention. So I think that's, you know, where we're at more broadly is still a very healthy, strong consumer. And especially in like our target segment is certainly upmarket, right? We are going to deal, you know, look at sort of the top quartile. So the top 25% of, you know, consumers within every sort of age and geographic, you know, age demographic and geographic area, we're going to sort of skew toward that top 25%. But I think that within that category, at least we're seeing, you know, continued strength and actually increasing flows on an ongoing basis.
Talk about the education side for a bit. You know, you mentioned options trading. You can get into a lot of trouble if you're not aware of how options work. And we've seen those stories kind of periodically come out in the media. What are some of the things that on the Public side you're doing to get retail to understand what exactly they're doing with their accounts?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple things, you know, factors that are important here. One, I will start from a place of like keeping it real, which is my lived experience. I've been doing this for, you know, call it 10 years of watching retail investors. They learn by doing, the vast majority, right? And so I think as we thought about constructing the options platform, I think if we start from the inside of retail investors learn by doing, there are two things that we built very specifically to help retail investors along. First, I think is a strict suitability criteria, which means for every, you know, member that comes in and requests access to options, you know, they have to tell us a bit about their investment goals and experience. And then we decide sort of what level is appropriate for them. And the truth is at this point, I think fewer than 60% or somewhere between 55 and 65% of the investors on Public that apply for options access are not granted any level of options access. And instead they're sort of put on a, you know, they're sort of put on a drip campaign of helpful educational materials that we want to see them sort of consume over a period of time before, you know, they can reapply and call it 3, 6, 9, 12 months and gain access, right? So I think that's first and foremost is like having that strict suitability criteria to make sure that really people that are using the product do have some experience and some reason to be doing so and have the capability to understand. The second is for all retail investors that come through and enable options, we have the option for them to have, you know, what we call like education mode, which basically delivers a bunch of overlays on the options experience for the first few times people go through it. So they can see what each of the, you know, what all the Greeks mean, what all of the sort of trading functions are and so on, and just make sure, hey, as they're doing, we sort of put the right learning materials in the way. And of course, underneath all of that, there's a, you know, a robust education center focused on options where we've got incredibly
you know, high quality, well-produced videos explaining all of the options, strategies, and what everything means. But I think we wanted to start from a place of like, you know, sort of building a foundation of ensuring via the suitability and via the education mode that every investor that comes through, like, you know, truly knows what they're doing and understands how to use the product safely.
What do you think people get most right and most wrong when it comes to the retail community? I go back to sort of early impressions. Yeah, you mentioned that you're getting more involved on the Reddit side and spending some time there. I think a lot of people are still of the mindset that a lot of retail are these, in quotes, degens that are just Reddit players and, you know, YOLOing into options, into individual positions. What's right and what's wrong on, in terms of the narrative?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest one is that, right? Which is like painting with a broad brush. And I think I've said multiple times, like, very hard to generalize about the retail market. There are tons of different, you know, profiles and behaviors and goals and strategies that all fit under that retail umbrella. And I think, you know, too often folks are willing to paint with a broad brush. And I think generally the second thing is that broad brush tends to paint retail as being, you said the words earlier, like dumb money. And I think, you know, listen, it's almost a truism to say that retail investors aren't going to know as much about the capital markets as somebody who does it for a living, right? You show up to the office and you spend 12 hours a day thinking about investing, right? Like, you're a professional, like, you are going to have, you know, hopefully you're not wasting your life. You're going to have some kind of incremental impact on your ability to make good investment decisions. That is for sure true. And that should be a truism, right? It's the same as like, you know, any profession, right? Where you've got people who are sort of, you know, doing it part-time or as a hobby versus people that are doing it professionally. There's obviously going to be a difference there. I think the thing that I think is underaccounted for is that field, that playing field is leveling over time. Retail investors, again, will never be professionals, right? They don't spend the time 12 hours a day thinking about it for the most part. Again, if they do, I think those that do invest that amount of time uniquely nowadays have a much smaller information availability gap than they used to. So the capability is there for retail investors to match sort of that level of sophistication as a professional. But even for those that are doing it, you know, part-time or as a hobby or as just like, you know, something they're interested in, want to stay engaged with the markets, the amount of information available to them and the ease with which you can consume quite a lot of information in a short period of time is way different than it's ever been before. And I think that dramatically improving sort of the outcomes and the decision-making of retail investors. And so I think painting retail as a broad, dumb money brush with a broad, dumb money brush is probably inaccurate. And, you know, there's another interesting proof point that I said earlier that I think retail investors are, I'm going to get real like industry wonky here, but like, you know, I think you'll find it interesting. You know, I said earlier about retail investors and how options trading volume among retail has stayed largely consistent while equities trading volume for retail has gone down over the last several years. So that's one trend that we've seen in sort of industry data. The second trend we've seen in industry data is the large, I won't name any, but the large retail brokers have started to see, you know, their options payment for order rate, or option payment for order flow rates fall over time. And there are a couple of driving factors that I'm not going to get into detail, but one of the driving factors of that is actually retail investors are having better outcomes on their options trade than before, right? And so the better retail investors are, you know, executing profitable options trade, the harder it is for those sort of payment for order flow mechanics work to make sense, because generally, you know, through the entire sort of market structure, somebody is taking that risk on the other side of that options trade. And the more retail wins, the harder it is, you know, the more money that comes out of the system and the harder it is for those payment for order flow rebates to stay super high. And so I think we've seen sort of at those large retail platforms, we've seen those rates fall dramatically. We're talking like 40 or 50% over the course of the last 2 years. And I think that again, hard to say specifically. Again, I don't work at those platforms. I haven't been in this business for a long time, but one of the driving forces of that is, in my opinion, the outcomes of retail investors in the options market are improving.
Steven, for those who want to track more of your thoughts or learn more about Public, where would you point to?
Yeah, follow me on Twitter, Steven_Sykes_, because, you know, Twitter hasn't figured out how to unlock suspended accounts for people to claim the super desirable handles anymore. That's one on Twitter. And then on Reddit, I'm just Public on Reddit. So those are the two places where, you know, you'll mostly find me in the community. But again, generally, if you ever have a need and you reach out to Public customer support, you can always ask for somebody to send a message Steven's way, et cetera. So a bunch of ways to get me. I try to do my best to be out there and, you know, interacting with our members and helping our members out and you know, trying to convince people to give us a shot. So if you're interested in public, please reach out. Happy to help you get set up.
Appreciate those that joined here. Please make sure you follow Stephen. I appreciate it, Stephen.
All right. Thanks, Michael.
Cheers, everybody.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at LeadLag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the LeadLag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.